WNYC Studios is supported by Dana-Farber Cancer Institute. Protein degradation can target and destroy cancer-causing proteins right inside the cell. It's how Dana-Farber is working to treat previously untreatable cancers. Learn more at DanaFarber.org/everywhere.
Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
I'm Brian Lehrer. This is my Daily Politics Podcast from WNYC Studios. It's Tuesday, January 4th. Now to the continuing discussion on inflation and what to do about it. You've seen the rising prices in your own life. You may have heard the 6.8% annual inflation rate stat at the end of last year, which hasn't been seen since 1982. Exactly 40 years to get back to this point. You also might have seen warnings of a recession and an otherwise worsening economy. So what to do about it? Well, according to my next guest, the economic landscape of 1981 and 82, the last time there was inflation this bad, is in some ways the mirror image of 2021 looking ahead to 2022. So what can we learn from that era long ago when Ronald Reagan was president that could be applied today? Here to explain is Neil Irwin. This comes from one of his last pieces in the New York Times. He just changed jobs and left the Times, called How the 2020s Economy Could Resemble the 1980s. He has since started a new job at Axios as their chief economics correspondent. Neil, welcome to WNYC and congrats on your new role.
Thank you, Brian.
So how is the U.S. economy today a mirror image of where it was in the 1980s? We will talk what's going on today, of course, because that's our central focus. But we'll also explore some history in this conversation, which I think will be interesting for some folks who lived through it and really interesting for some folks who didn't. So why do you use the term mirror image for today's economy compared to the early 1980s?
So, you know, people forget just how bad the employment situation, how bad the recession in the early 1980s really was. If you look back to December 1981, January 1982, that's 40 years ago right now, you had extremely high unemployment and rising. You also had high inflation, but inflation was coming down. The reason I believe this is kind of the opposite situation, we have inflation that's high and rising, and you have unemployment that's been coming down very rapidly. You have a very strong labor market right now. So essentially, it's the mirror image in the sense that if things change quickly, like they did in the early 1980s, then you do have a situation in which inflation starts to come down, but it might take a while. And that's where we stand.
That's where we stand. And what did we have in the 1970s? People who were alive then may remember with some derision high inflation in the short presidency of Gerald Ford, and that was really 1974 to 76, I guess, after Nixon left office because of Watergate, and Gerald Ford's seemingly bumbling whip inflation now buttons that people were supposed to wear that didn't whip inflation now. But what caused the inflation of the 1970s?
I mean, the way you have to look at it is not just those couple of years in the late 70s or early 80s, but as part of a long process that spread out over 15, 17 years, dating back to the mid 60s. And what happened is you had this process where a bunch of price pressures were building in the economy, wages were rising very rapidly, and that was kind of passing through. It's called the wage price spiral, where employers are paying more to their workers. Workers have more money to spend on goods, but that productivity isn't rising fast enough. And so you have this kind of circular process where prices keep rising. You had some shocks. You had the gold standard was abandoned in 1971. You had oil shocks in the mid-70s. And all those things kept building on themselves and creating this self-sustaining process that led inflation from quite low levels in the mid-1960s to 10-12% by the late 70s, early 1980s. And this became a broader crisis of confidence. You know, it creates a sense of society being unmoored, of things being out of control, of you know, the competence of government being in question, the kind of national unity being in question. So it really is a process and a problem that goes deeper than just, milk's more expensive at the grocery store.
And you wrote about the Federal Reserve at that time pulling off a delicate economic pivot and that the way that the Fed might do that now is different from what was done four decades ago. So what did the Fed do back then? And I'll do a little bit of spoiler here. Interest rates, I mean, compared to what we know, people who are living through, you know, recent years, even recent decades, with very low interest rates in support of economic growth, when you look back to this history and see what interest rates were in the 1980s on purpose as government policies, it can make your head explode.
It really does. You know, so we have this inflation building throughout the 70s. Eventually, Jimmy Carter appoints Paul Volcker to lead the Federal Reserve. And Volcker applies essentially shock therapy to the U.S. economy, raises interest rates very dramatically, up to, you know, you hear stories of mortgage rates at 20-25%, things like that. And that was a real effort to essentially change the entire framework of the economy, to convince businesses and consumers that this isn't going to be, we're not going to let this inflation happen anymore. And it caused a severe recession. Again, there were technically two recessions in the very end of the 70s and in 1981-82. You know, I think if you know, I was very young then, I was a child, but people who lived through that in their working years will tell you it was a really difficult time to be an American worker. You know, we reached 10% unemployment, highest since World War II at the time. You know, it was painful, but it did the job. It really did result in a change in inflationary expectations. It resulted in labor unions, you know, being willing to not accept, not demand such enormous raises. It changed the kind of the psychology throughout the American economy of inflation. And so we then had really 25 years in which inflation expectations and inflation, reality was falling, arguably, you know, too low in the last 10, 15 years.
How high did interest rates get at the hand of the Fed in the 1980s?
Their target rate, I don't know it off the top of my head. It was 18%, something like that. But, you know, just stuff that's really out of the realm of people who have mainly been living their economic lives in the last decade, things that you just can't even imagine. And so
right.
You had people buying mortgages, you know, buying houses, and what might seem like a, you know, reasonable price for a house doesn't seem so reasonable when you're paying 20-25% for your mortgage rate.
20-25% for mortgage rates, 18% as a benchmark target rate by the Fed. Bank accounts or money market accounts that were paying double digit percentages in interest rates. I mean, it's inconceivable from today's perspective. So were there particular winners and losers in that kind of an interest rate environment?
There were. Before that, I will correct myself. I just looked it up. The discount rate the Fed sets peaked at 14% in August 1981.
Okay.
There are winners and losers in an inflationary environment. And the traditional story that economists tell is, you know, if you're on net, if you're a creditor, if you're somebody who people owe money to, you're a loser because, you know, people are paying you back with money that's worth 10% less than what you lent them. If you're a debtor, it's in theory better because you're still earning. So let's say you, you know, owed a lot of money on a home mortgage that you had taken out in the 60s and 1980 rolls around. Your wages have risen a lot because of inflation. So paying off those debts becomes a lot easier. In reality, you know, everybody's kind of on both sides of these things in different ways. You know, it's also, you know, the mix of things you buy matters a lot, right? So if you're somebody who drives a gas guzzler and oil prices spike and gasoline prices spike, that's a bigger deal for you. And, you know, say you have a long commute than somebody who walks to work or takes the subway. So, you know, these things are variable by individual. But I think, again, there is this sense that people feel unmoored, that even people who are on net, you know, do fine in an inflationary environment really don't like it. We see that in the public opinion data, both right now and back in the 80s. You see it in kind of the psychology of inflation.
Did it work to tame inflation?
It did. You know, again, quite a steep price. It was a very severe recession. But we did have this environment where Inflation went from being a foremost problem in the early 1980s to, you know, by the 90s, kind of an afterthought and really not a central concern. And so in many ways, the economic policymakers since Volcker have enjoyed the benefits of the credibility that the Federal Reserve and the kind of overall monetary system attained during his leadership. And so if you're Alan Greenspan, Ben Bernanke, Janet Yellen, Jay Powell, you are still kind of enjoying the dividends of the credibility that inflation won't become a severe problem that Paul Volcker helped attain.
Do we see already? Well, I guess one of the questions about inflation right now is whether it's transitory because of the pandemic creating insane conditions, supply shortages, everything that will just ease as the pandemic eases, or whether it's a symptom of more longer term inflationary pressures that are really going to have to be dealt with more long-term economic policy. How do you see? Are you on what some people call team transitory or team persistent?
So I don't love that framing. It became very popular among kind of people who talk about economics on Twitter over the last year. I thought last summer, for example, the evidence this was going to be transitory was pretty reasonable. And we even saw that with some things. So for example, lumber prices spiked in the spring and came down in the summer. But the longer this has gone on, the more I think there's real evidence that there's some psychology shifting and some changes in the economy happening that if we're not careful, could prove more lasting. We're seeing workers are very empowered and are quitting their jobs at high rates and demanding wages. But that's all great. But it's not keeping up with the kind of inflation we're seeing in the economy. And the wider that spreads, the more we could see employers start to really pass those higher costs on to consumers in a way that becomes that wage price spiral we talked about a minute ago from the 1970s. And one more thing I'll just add for the historical kind of comparison, you know, the inflation of the 70s involved a lot of one-time shocks too, things that were supposed to be transitory. Again, going off the gold standard in 1971, the energy and oil shocks of the mid-70s. But sometimes when you have those shocks at a time when there are already deeper forces brewing and deeper economic trends brewing, they just reinforce and strengthen those underlying trends. And that's what I think Jerome Powell at the Fed and other economic policymakers are keeping a really close eye on. You know, yes, maybe the supply constraints and the backlogs at ports are a temporary thing and those will go away one of these days. But have they accentuated forces that are setting in place different pricing behavior than we've seen over the last 15 years, and will that have lasting consequences?
Do you find inflation morally complex at all? Like, we've certainly had guests on this show who are very happy that wages are starting to rise because labor is in demand and people are being more choosy after the Great Resignation, as it's called, and all of that during the pandemic. You know, since the 1970s, we've seen this decades-long pattern where the rich have gotten richer and the middle class has stagnated and shrunk. And now, for the first time in a long time, there's upward pressure on wages, which would be a reason for progressives to cheer. That, of course, however, is part and parcel of inflation. So how do you come down on the moral complexity of that? Because, you know, we want working and middle class people to do better than they've been doing. But then we say we don't want inflation, but they're related.
They are. I think to economists, those are two sides of the same coin, right? If wages are rising, workers are empowered, that's all great. And it's fantastic. And after a long time when people did not see raises, it's great they're seeing them. On the other side, if companies are able to just pass those costs straight through to prices, people don't really end up better off, right? If we're in an environment where companies are able to hold on to their profit margins and, again, pass on higher wages, yes, you might be making more, but if your groceries cost more, everything you buy costs more, you're not really in better shape than where you started. What you want to see is wage gains that are higher than inflation. You know, you want people's wages to rise faster than the things that they buy. And, the tricky thing is you don't know, you know, that comes down to kind of corporate power and what ability companies have to pass along past price increases. And we don't really know how this is going to shake out, right, as this evolves. We're seeing all the evidence of very strong wage gains, especially at the lower end of the spectrum. People have agency. They have a sense of power. They're quitting their jobs at record rates. At the same time, so far, all the supply constraints that, you know, we've talked about that involved the pandemic are creating higher prices. We don't know which is going to prove more powerful over the course of 2022. That's the key thing to watch.
Hank in Monmouth County remembers the 1980s. Hi, Hank. You're on WNYC.
Hey, thank you. My question was, I got married in 1983. And before we got married, we saved all our money and we had a savings account. So we had a high interest rate. It allowed us to buy our first home. And what I see today is everybody's in a stock market. And, of course, back in those days, once the stock market went up, everybody went into it, and then we had the collapses. So my point is, if everybody's forced to go into the stock market without an interest rate on their monies, it kind of puts you at the mercy of the financial institutions, which they make money if you lose, and they make money if you win.
Hank, thank you so much for what I think is a very important point. And I think a lot of seniors struggle with that today. They don't want to take the risks of the stock market, never mind, the kind of political interests that some people might have in not supporting Wall Street, but the risks inherent with the financial markets, even because you can't get a decent interest rate from a bank anymore. And so people are kind of forced into that, whether they want to be or not, in order to keep up with inflation. So for some people, like Hank was describing, that old high interest rate environment was better. It was more secure.
Yeah, I mean, I understand where the sentiment comes from. And when you could get 10% on your savings accounts, that sounded great. I will say, like, if you're earning 10% on your savings account, but inflation's 12%, you're still losing ground year after year. It just looks like the numbers are getting bigger. That said, we do have very low. So economists talk about real interest rates, meaning what are interest rates adjusted for expected inflation? And right now, those have been extremely low. I mean, think about over the last year, basically zero interest rates on any kind of safe savings account, things like that. 0% combined with 6-7% inflation. So you're getting a negative 7% real return, inflation adjusted return. That's really losing ground at a rapid pace. It's no wonder that people are unhappy with that and don't like their options. We can talk about the reasons real interest rates, inflation adjusted interest rates are so low. It involves global forces, it involves wealth inequality, it involves demographics, a lot of things going on. But it is just the reality of the economy right now. And there's no doubt if you're a saver and you don't want to take risk, you want your money to be safe, you are going to be losing the economic ground. And that's kind of the nature of the economy we're in right now.
Scott in Soho, you're on WNYC with Neil Irwin. Hi, Scott.
Yeah, hi. I wanted to ask, what's the real effect on poor people or the lower income people with this? Because I can tell you, filling up my gas tank went from $30 or $32 up to $47. And I do that once a week. So if you do the math, it adds up pretty quick. And also energy prices are, my home energy price is already up 25%. So, I mean, I'm looking at already another $3,000 a year, right off the top just for energy. And I'm curious, why we're not talking about that. I thought we were supposed to be helping the poor. And it looks like this is not really helping the poor because, if you're making $35,000 a year and you're paying $30,000 or $3,000 more in gas prices or energy prices, that's a big hit.
Right. But inflation is not a government policy. So Neil, I don't know how you respond to his.
Yeah, I mean, look, I think the thing that is, if you talk to kind of lower income people kind of just scratching by, you see how precarious their finances often are, right? If you're making, $30,000 a year, and trying to, pay for food, transportation, get to work, housing, all of that, you just don't have a lot of cushion in there if the price of something rises. So there's, I think more affluent people there tends to be a lot more buffers, a lot more ability. You know, you probably are saving at a higher rate. You're probably, you know, you can, if the grocery bill is higher, you can cut back on some luxuries without it being too big a deal. Whereas people who are just scraping by have less of those buffers. I will say one thing to keep in mind, that what we're seeing is wages are rising fastest at the lower end of the spectrum. So, for example, restaurant workers are seeing extremely rapid wage increases, something like 9-10%. You know, whereas white collar professionals and, you know, fields like financial services or real estate communications, these are fields where wages have not been rising as fast. So, you know, that's kind of the good news, is that, you know, people who are, you know, working at in retail jobs and in restaurants and in hotels and food service, things like that, they are seeing bigger pay gains. But it's not clear for any individual, that still might not be enough to cover higher cost of living.
Yeah.
And, you know, for each individual, it can be a very different story.
So as we come toward the end of the segment, politically, do you see Biden and today's Fed chief, Jerome Powell, doing anything specific? They obviously want to resist the super high interest rates of the 1980s that we've been talking about. But is there an anti-inflation policy? And also politically, you know, it seems like the Republicans are saying you should make inflation the heart of your economic policy. And Biden is trying to make the longer term economic inequality through the Build Back Better program the heart of his policy.
Yeah, I mean, it's a very delicate balance for both the Fed and for the Biden administration. So the Fed has started to pivot to being more focused on inflation and trying to, you know, move toward raising interest rates sooner rather than later. It looks like in the first half of the year, we'll probably see interest rate increases. You know, that's a real change from where they were as recently as the first week of November. They made a it's called a hawkish pivot toward tighter money. So they are focused on this now. You know, they're trying to turn the dial very gingerly. They don't want to kill the economy and kill the recovery. They don't want to cause a recession, but they do want to pull in these inflationary pressures that have been building. For Biden, you know, the White House has done a lot of things on kind of the micro level. So, for example, there was all these port backlogs. They convened, you know, things with the longshoremen and the ports and the retailers and the shippers and tried to, you know, clear out some of those knots in the ports, for example. So lots of micro things like that. You know, they are casting Building Back Better as a long-term plan that will actually create disinflationary forces. You know, I think it's whether you believe that story or not, the politics are very delicate. And Joe Manchin, the key senator who will basically decide what gets through or doesn't, has been very clear that he thinks inflation is a first order problem and that the government should not be doing anything that might cause more inflation. So, look, this is a political mess for Biden. It's a very challenging environment for Democrats heading into midterms in November. You know, you see it in the public opinion polls. You see it in economic confidence polling. You know, this is really weighing on people. And if it doesn't change soon, that will probably continue.
Do you have an opinion as an economics reporter about whether Build Back Better would be inflationary because it's a lot of government spending, so that would push up prices, or whether it would be anti-inflationary in the way that Biden argues?
I think it's not a strong force either way over time. How it all nets out, the economists can build their models and try and guess. But, you know, the thing to remember about Build Back Better, it's over 10 years. It's spread out over many years. It's not as big for any one year as the headline number suggests. And it includes, as the Biden people will point out, it does include measures that ought to be disinflationary in theory. But, you know, at the same time, if you're pushing more money into the economy, that's also more money floating around bidding up the price of goods and services. So I know I'm ducking the question, but I really think it's an ambiguous story that people shouldn't have excess confidence in their view.
Neil Irwin, chief economic correspondent at Axios Now, after just leaving the New York Times, reporting on the economy there. Thanks so much for joining us. Good luck in your new gig.
Thank you, Brian.
Brian Lehrer, a daily politics podcast, is an excerpt from my live daily radio show, The Brian Lehrer Show, on WNYC Radio, 10 a.m. to noon Eastern Time, if you want to listen live at WNYC.org. Thanks for listening today. Talk to you next time.